This is HPR 2945 for Friday, the 15th of November, 2019. Today's show is entitled Saturday at Oldcamp Manchester 2019, and it's part of the series Interviews. It's hosted by Ken Fallon and is about 37 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is Interviews and Chat from the UK's largest floss event.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon and you're listening to another episode of Hacker Public Radio. Today's show is going to be a series of recordings that were recorded at Oldcamp 2019 in Manchester. So sit back, relax and enjoy the show. And I'm talking to?
Marshall or Tim Timmy.
And you are the owner of the HPR booth kit, surely?
I am the current maintainer.
Exactly. And you refuse to do this show, so I have to do it as an interview, which is a bit of a waste. Because I'm looking here at a print of HPR-push-cam, which is live now on...
Ogcam.live.
Which will be off the air by the time
yeah,
you
it'll be
get this.
Yeah,
it could be a picture of a quarry or something.
It could be some anything random like that, yeah. So, I decided to... one of the guys on Mastodon... Stockholm asked if I was going to put up the web-enabled camera again this year. Hadn't even thought about it. I don't know where it was. So was going to set it up with FS camera on a laptop.
Okay, so now what he's talking about is, as I walk over here, there's a, what would you call that thing? There's a clip here with a...
It's a car phone holder mount.
Yeah, car phone holder mount with yeah. One of these metal tubey things.
Bendy things.
For holding things. And in it is a mobile phone, which is pointing here. But this is the genius of this. It's running a regular Android phone, and then you've written a script. Tell us about that.
Well, the script was my first attempt at using a laptop. Images weren't great. So I thought there must be a way of doing this with a phone. So I've got a spare old Nexus 5X Android phone and fired up Termux, which is a terminal emulator for Android. I thought I'd install FS webcam, which you can't. So
that's FS webcam.
Yes. So a little bit of Googling. I found out the Termux exposed the API for the camera, and it's a a five-line script? Six. Which is just a simple bash loop, fires up the camera, takes a photograph, image magic then resizes it to make it web friendly then, but not a 6 megabyte picture, just a few kilobytes, and then SSH pass and SCP, send it up to my server.
Okay, I'm manly enough to read this out. Yeah. While true, do... fs-cam /d/dev/video0/-jpeg/95/save/current.jpg. So
FS webcam
then
it's Linux and Windows, but it's on my Linux laptop. So that was just for testing with.
Yeah.
And then the Termux version is the one we're using now.
Okay, so then to finish off the FS webcam, you have SSH pass, -f.space.ssh pass, scp-port22, and then the file, and then up to the web server, and then sleep, and then that's it.
That's it.
But the Termux version, this is interesting. Why could you not do this, use the same script on Android then?
Because SF webcam is not available on Android.
Good answer.
That is excellent. The entire reason.
Ticket sticker.
So yeah, the Termux version is basically the same. Instead of FS webcam, it's using Termux-camera-photo, which is, you can install it in Termux through its own package installer. And then it's the same, the convert is ImageMagick, which again you can install in Termux. And SH Pass is installable in Termux and SCP.
So, is anything here not available on the Android store? Would you need a rooted application in order to do any of this?
No, because that phone's running Copperhead, which is locked down. You can't root a Copperhead OS Android phone.
Okay, good to know.
But it doesn't work on my BlackBerry Key 2, which is locked down, and it won't let it access the camera.
So your mileage may vary. Now, what I found interesting about this was that if you go and buy an IP camera, you're talking 150 whatever bucks. There's a robot walking past with an iPad on it. Okay, anywho. But if you buy a cheap Android phone, you could have essentially a web monitoring solution for very little on a 5-line script.
Yes, and the advantage of the phone is you stick a SIM card in it, you can go and stick it on a cliff and look at the sea and leave it there.
Yeah, okay, I get that.
Do with a lot of your web-enabled cameras that need to be plugged into the mains.
Okay, cool. The picture of this will be in the show notes at least.
Okay.
All right, thanks. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you. Cheers, Ken.
And we're here at the Matrix booth, and I'm talking to...
Hi, I'm Ben. You might know me as Ben Pa. That's what I'm known as on the Matrix ecosystem.
And what is Matrix? People of HPR will know I've interviewed the Matrix before at FOSDEM, but give us a quick rundown on what it is.
Yeah, I'm sure Matrix is fairly familiar to your listeners. So Matrix is a decentralized communication platform. It's self-hostable, so that you can use your own server or start up a new server and host your own Matrix instance. It's also end-to-end encrypted, which means that messages are encrypted on the client, sent through the servers, sent over the internet, and sent to your recipient, and the whole time it's encrypted. So when they decrypt it, they'll be the only ones who've been able to read the message.
Okay, and is this for text messages or is it video conferencing?
So Matrix, the standard, specifies the use of text messaging, files, images, sounds. But Matrix can also be used as a signaling layer for VoIP, so for WebRTC. And in particular, we make use of Jitsi. So we're a layer on top of video messaging. We're a signaling layer on top.
Okay, and Jitsi is what?
Oh, Jitsi is a open source video conferencing software. You host a server, or you use a free public server, and in doing so, you can send many to many. You can have basically video conferencing from multiple people. For single users, we would say use WebRTC, and Matrix can be used natively there.
Okay, and so what would that be exactly? Say I wanted to talk to my family with video. What would I need to do?
So if you both had a Matrix account, let's say you didn't have a Matrix account. First of all, you would need to sign up for one. You create a room with everybody in there. That's a room is like a channel on IRC. And when you've done that, you start a new video chat. For a multi-user chat, that will use Jitsi. For a single user or two-user chat, it will use WebRTC. The UI-wise, the difference is transparent to the user. So they just, as far as they know, they start a new video chat, and it's as simple as that. And of course, that works across all platforms that Riot works on. So Riot is the flagship client for Matrix. So it works across all major platforms, including web, desktop, Android, iOS.
So what are you showing here on the booth? I'm looking down at your booth and you've got a screen, two Raspberry Pis, a phone connected to a MacBook Pro.
Yeah. So we've got a lot of hardware on the table. So what we have is we're trying to demonstrate the using the screen, the different configurations of Matrix. So we're showing off the network diagram of Matrix. We also have a few tabs open.
So the network diagram is showing three blue balls connected like a triangle, And then around each of the blue balls are green little lollipops stuck into them would be the best idea.
So yeah, as bizarre as that sounds, that's actually, we found that to be a really nice way of demonstrating the idea of centralization. So those big blue balls in the middle, they show your servers, and what they show is that they send messages between each other in a process that we call federation. So this is syncing messages and event history between only the rooms that the messages apply to. In doing this, the green lollipops, as you call them, these represent clients, and they are then able to get the details from the servers, and in this way, you control who gets what messages via a mechanism of rooms. So only the rooms which are appropriate to the server and appropriate to the users get to see those messages. This is the fundamental security part of Matrix.
And then from a topology point of view, it's quite similar to email, I guess. It's defederated.
Yeah, absolutely that. I mean, it's...
Sorry, decentralized, yes, federated.
Yes. Yeah. It's decentralized and federated. So yes, you really could liken it to email. When you send an email from your client, it goes to your server. That is sent to the correct server. Of course, in email's case, that's that could be multiple servers. The message is only sent back to the clients as determined by the recipient server.
Okay, perfect. So show me a typical demo here, and I will translate it on screen. So we're clicking the tab, Alice in Wonderland, some text, lovely.
So what we've got here, we've got several Raspberry Pis on the table. Each of the Raspberry Pis is currently running a Matrix server, and each of the devices is attached to a bot, and those bots are sending the text from a Project Gutenberg book. So we've got Gulliver's Travels coming from one bot, Alice in Wonderland coming from another bot, and what we show with this demo is that when one of them is unplugged, yes, it stops sending messages because it's not able to connect to the network any longer, but when it's plugged back in, it will continue to operate, and it will also get backfill from the other servers, so it will be able to see the messages it missed because it knows when it went offline, and it knows how to catch up, and it will catch up from the other server.
And a Raspberry Pi is sufficient to run Matrix on it, is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So these, funnily enough, our Raspberry Pi 4, this is a 2 gig of RAM edition, died this morning. So we're running the entire operation from a pair of Raspberry Pi 3s. And yeah, for basic Matrix usage, it's one gigabyte on a Raspberry Pi 3 is sufficient, and we're showing that in the demo right now. Matrix will use more resources as the rooms that you join become more complex. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of a natural artifact of any messaging system. For the demo that we're doing here and for a huge number of people's usage, a Raspberry Pi 3 is sufficient. I would also say that another demonstration of the improved low-level performance of Matrix has been the release of small hosted home servers from Modular. This is a commercial SaaS offering of Matrix, and they've been able to deploy low-cost, low-usage servers and that's something that's only come out this year. So this is a success that they've had this year.
Okay, fantastic. And what's your involvement with the project?
So I'm employed to be a Matrix developer advocate. So I go to events like this, I talk to people like you, and I also talk to anybody else who would like to hear about Matrix. I even talk to people who don't want to hear about Matrix. So what we do is we try to humanize the project. The problem with a lot of open source, and Matrix is not immune to this, is that it's a very complicated project. If you compare it to WhatsApp, then answering the question, well, I'm already chatting to my friends, why would I need anything else, is not obvious. To a crowd like this, and to a listener like yours, it probably is obvious why you would want to have security, self-hosting, privacy, end-to-end encryption, data transparency. But it's really not obvious to everybody. And by doing demos like these, something that's a little bit strange, maybe a little bit more interesting, we try to demonstrate the value of Matrix and how it can be used in other ways.
And who should we, you have a business, you're employed by somebody, you're getting paid, where's the money come from, who?
So I'm employed by NeuVector, which is the largest contributor to the Matrix ecosystem, but my time is devoted to promotion of the Matrix.
And how are they making money using Matrix?
So they sell Modular and they sell consultancy. So most prominently, they are supplying Matrix consultancy to the French government to replace their internal communications. They've been doing that for just over a year, and that project is continuing to be a profitable consultancy.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Ben. Anything else we missed?
Oh, no. Only if you haven't done so, you must sign up for Matrix. Go and join the rooms. And please get in touch with us over Matrix. Thanks.
Yeah, but you can even go to like jit.se/something. Just type in your own thing and you get instantaneous access to a video conference. Are we using Matrix when we do that?
So you're only using Matrix when you're using a Matrix to signal the VoIP.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be related to just typing out your SIP address yourself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, and I'm talking to?
Alan Wood.
And you are?
Laurie Griffiths.
So what are you starting you with UL? What's are we looking at here? I'm looking at the desk, and can you describe what's before me?
What I'm here today showing is the latest generation of a product called Black Ice. Now, back in 2016, we started a project called MyStorm, which was to produce some open source hardware for programming FPGAs that works alongside the open source software tool chains.
What's an FPGA? GA?
Right. FPGA stands for Field Programmable Gate Array. Basically, it's a chip that has lots of logic in it, but it's uncommitted to any specific application.
So you can put your own AND or gates and stuff?
Yeah, you can think of it as a huge number of logic gates that you can juggle and mix to make whatever you want. So that may be something simple, like a piece of electronics control equipment, for maybe controlling some motors or some panels or something of that nature. Or it could be something more sophisticated, like you want to design your own new CPU, for example, because you've got a great idea on how a CPU should be designed. So you obviously can't just go to a chip maker and tell them what you want. You have to come up with a design and you have to test that design. The way that you do that is you use some sort of tool for producing the design. In the hardware world, that tends to be what's called a hardware description language. In most of our cases, people will use a tool or a language called Verilog. So you can then write your Verilog, you can express the logic of your design in Verilog. You then take that to Clifford Wolf's open source tool called Yosys, which will take the Verilog program, if you like, as an input, and then it will synthesize the output. So it'll break it down into those logical parts that will be available in the chip, and then it will output that through one of several different what's called place and route pieces of software that target very specific FPGAs. So for example, in our case, we're using the Lattice Ice 40 FPGA on our chips. So that's what we would target for our device.
So that's, I'm looking at a board here, it's about an inch, so
50 by 50 mil.
50 by 50 mil.
In metric terms.
In metric terms, thank you.
Let's not be old fashioned. But yeah. So it's almost a couple of inches by a couple of inches. So back in 2016, you had to kind of go out and buy vendor type boards for development. And those weren't very hackable in our opinion, so we figured we could do a better job, do something, design an open source hardware development board specifically for these open source FPGA toolkits using Yosys. So we came up with the idea of this project called MyStorm, and to set ourselves a challenge, I think it was like May after we'd done this talk where we decided in a pub, like you do, to do this thing, that by, I think it was either the end of August or beginning of September, I think it was end of August, when Oshkamp was on in Hebden Bridge, that we'd have, you know, however many of these, enough to run a workshop and teach basic FPGA to the people attending Oshkamp on the Sunday.
Yep.
And, you know, we just kind of managed to do it. We received the boards like 2 days before the event. Had to do a bit of extra soldering and fixing and stuff on the boards, but then managed to run these workshops on this board. And after that, people wanted to use the boards. You know, we got requested, well, can we buy these boards and things? So we figured, oh, well, let's clean it up a bit, get the things fixed that we've gotten wrong, and start making boards for this and make them available.
So, is this like a business now?
I haven't given up my day job yet.
But the dream is there.
The dream is there, yes. So we're now on like the fifth generation of this board, effectively, at the moment. And some of the changes we recently made is it actually comes in two parts. One of the problems you had before is, even though it supports these standards, which are called PMODs, which you can buy these off-the-shelf parts that plug into the FPGA, piece of hardware, like displays, LEDs.
So what I'm looking at here is you're plugging in little add-on circuit boards.
Have a standard connector format. So although that's quite good, what you end up with after your prototype is something that's very difficult to put in a box, because it kind of sticks out at all angles, and it's mechanically it's not very stable. So one of the design goals for the latest version of the board was to separate the really complicated bit that we have to get made in a factory with all the small surface mount stuff on, and then the board that plugs into, which breaks it out to the PMOD, you can take that off, and then you can design your own board for this module to go into. So you can integrate it into your own projects much more easily than you could before. And in fact, the Black Ice MX, which is the current product that we sell, is two boards designed around the Black Edge standard, which is these connector formats, which defines what those are, and that's an open standard. And anyone can build a board that plugs in, or a core that plugs into the board. So we call that bit the carrier, the lower bit.
So a bit like an ashtray from Days of Yore, but a very small one. And then there's
the core bit that plugs in the top, basically. So that enables, it was one of the things that the community had said to us for a while, you know, we've got some great stuff on there, but can we have it so that we can put it in our projects much more easily?
So the center board looks very, very compact and designed by, whereas the other one is like a daughter module from a spaceship where you dock into.
Exactly, and that could be any board that you wanted to design if you wanted to do that.
And over here, I'm looking at one of these setups. So you've got the complicated main board plugged into a dock board, and inside of that there's an extension board which goes over to a
breadboard.
Yeah.
So prototyping.
Yeah. So for people that may not be familiar with a breadboard is basically a series of holes that you can put through-hole components into, like LEDs, displays, resistors, capacitors, and build a small circuit, prototype circuit, on the breadboard. And then have your development board then interact with that. So it's very good for just trying out very simple circuits, really. You can't do very complicated ones on there, but you can do very simple interfacing on there to simple through-hole components.
Okay, and north of that, we have a more complicated board where you've got a LED digit display.
Yeah, so this is a 7-segment display of 3 digits. These are very commonly used in all sorts of different applications for just representing numerical values. In this case, they're also very good for educational. So if you're learning Verilog, learning how to drive one of these is a really good exercise, because it teaches you all the basic things that you need to know to get started with Verilog. So we find out from educational type applications, people tend to want to buy these to go with this. In this particular case, we're also using one of what we call our extender or breakout boards in between the development and the PMOD. That means that we can plug our logic analyzer or oscilloscope onto the pins in between. So we can actually look at the signals going between the two devices as well.
So you could take that centerpiece out. So you're having a trouble, you could split this out, put the centerpiece in to tap in and do diagnostics, and then put
it and actually look at the signals and see what's going on. So if we've got some sort of problem, you know, and we say, no, it wasn't my code's perfect, you know, you look at it and say, oh, well, maybe my code isn't quite perfect, I can see my timing's wrong, and that's why it's displaying exactly the wrong thing. So it gives you a chance to get, it's kind of a man in the middle attack debugging tool, if you like, so you can get in there and have a look at the signals. So again, that's another popular one. And then you get things like a prototype or patch type module. Really, that's a bit like the breadboard in many ways. You have a header on that fixes in, that enables you to connect to the mix mod.
Yeah.
And then you can actually solder components in onto here.
Either through hole or...
Yeah, and do a little prototype. So having worked out how it works on your breadboard, and then you want to go to the next stage and make it more permanent, test it properly, then you can put it in on one of these proto or patch boards. Another common use of this is you may just have another type of connector on the other side that has like a compatible like header sort of spacing, in which case all you're doing is you're doing wires from one to the other, and it becomes a simple kind of patch type board. So that's another common use of.
Do you find people are actually using this to prototype real products in the real world?
Yeah, I mean, for example, I mean, people would use it for learning quite a lot. We have a lot of people that buy these boards purely for educational purposes. Well, that's personal type education, because they just want to try and program an FPGA or learn Verilog, that kind of thing. We also have educational establishments that use them in situ, you know, on courses and things like that. But for example, we have one chap that's actually designing an ultrasound viewing device. Yeah. So what he's using, he uses a high speed analog to digital converter for the ultrasonic parts. So sending out signals, reading it back, decoding that digitally, processing it in the FPGA, and then he connects a Raspberry Pi to the FPGA, and then the Raspberry Pi will then draw it up on the screen, you know, do the image processing so we can see what's going on the screen. So he's kind of built his own ultrasound viewing device. And the reason that he uses the FPGA is because you need something to work very quickly.
Yes.
You know, you'd have trouble doing that with a microcontroller, for example. So it's very high speed analog to digital conversion.
And because you can decide what the logic gates arrays are, you, correct me if I'm wrong here, please do, you basically write your program on the FPGA, a hardware program on the FPGA, and then you get light speed sort of processing.
Exactly. You can have very, very low latencies, you know, down in the tens of nanoseconds from input to output. Whereas if you did it on the microcontroller, then you have to process every clock cycle, every several instructions. It's a lot slower to do that. So you wouldn't be able to get back in time for your next sample, so you'd be dropping samples, and it just wouldn't work.
So basically you're the Raspberry Pi or the Arduino of FPGAs. That's where you're going to.
Kind of thinking, and we're trying to help to simplify that as much as possible. Yeah, by providing the extra bits and pieces so you can plug in. And also, we have a microcontroller on here as well, which is actually responsible for talking to the computer, the PC or the laptop, so that when you send your design, it will then program the FPGA for you, and it will program the flash for you, and all the utilities are built in. You don't have to go and buy a JTAG programmer and all that kind of. We put everything on the board to make it easier. On the MX, we've also added 2 megabytes of SD RAM, which is a lot more than inside the FPGA. So particularly if you're building a system on a chip, i.e. a soft RISC-V processor or something like that, or your latest experimental CPU design, it's got some memory to use as well to store its programs and do its processing. So we try and put all the bits that you need, you know, onto the board, really.
And you're at mystorm.com.
If you go to mystorm.uk, actually.
Yeah. Oh, mystorm.uk, I should have seen that, it's right here in front of me. And can you give me an idea of what the pricing of this is?
So if you were to buy a Black Ice MX in American dollars, so if you were to go and buy that from Tindy, for example, it would be $59, which roughly translates, given that Boris hasn't said anything really stupid in the last few hours, to about £45.
We're on one of the Brexit days here. Pick one.
So
that's actually quite reasonable for an FPGA, considering what the prices were.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were always very conscious when we started the project that we wanted it to be, you know, accessible to hobbyists, educational, etc., not just professional FPGA designers kind of thing. So we wanted to make it a purchase that someone could make and not worry too much about how much it was costing.
Much money on
50. No, we don't, which is probably why I haven't given my day job up.
Yeah.
I see where you're going with this, yeah. So what else do we have on here at the stand demo-wise? Impress me.
Okay. Well, Laurie is showing...
And I'm going to put photos in the show notes, even though I hate doing that because I need to remember to do it, but I will because there's some good stuff here.
About systems on chips and some of the retro type computing applications and games and things. He, as a user and an early user of the Black Ice and the more modern Black Ice MX, he's got lots of experience of developing with it, so he can give you some examples of things that he's done.
Okay, hi Laurie.
Hi, I'm Laurie Griffiths. Yes, I've been using Alan's device for about 18 months or so now, so I've done lots of projects with it. So on the stand here, you can see some retro computer implementations. There's an Acorn Atom implementation and a Nintendo Entertainment System running Super Mario Brothers on it.
Okay, so you've got the Black Ice module here, and then plugged in on the side, I see there's a PS2 keyboard. What's this say?
Oh,
that's
not being used for that. That's just this. There's a VGA PMOD here that's used to drive the VGA monitor.
And you're powering it all off from three rechargeable batteries.
Oh, the only reason I'm using the rechargeable batteries is because the PS2 keyboard connector that won't drive this Microsoft wireless keyboard without some extra power. It's got a 5-volt power to drive that.
And so you're physically emulating the hardware of these old devices?
Yes, that's right. So there's an implementation of the 6502 CPU in there, plus all the video drivers, the keyboard drivers, and everything else.
So you went down and physically designed this in all the logic gates.
Well,
where did you get that?
Well, people have been working on these for quite a few years now, but only recently on the open hardware and the open source software tools. But there's older implementations. So basically, these are ports of ports of ports from that people have been working on for many years. So I think the Nintendo one was originally done in about 2012 on a completely different FPGA, and then someone ported it to a UFP5K FPGA. So there's one called the Icebreaker that I've got here with a HDMI connector.
Yep.
So I ported it to that first, and then I ported it to the Black Ice MX board, which the issue there is that there's this SD-RAM, and it's a bit harder to use SD-RAM for retro computers because you have to get exact timing. I've managed to do that for the Acorn Atom. There is also an implementation of the BBC Micro for Alan's earlier board, the Black Ice 2, but I haven't managed to port to the new Black Ice MX board yet.
As this Super Mario looks exactly like it did back in the day.
Yes, it's the same software exactly that's running, and it should be a cycle accurate implementation of it. Yes.
Cool, excellent stuff. Well, thank you very much, guys, for taking the time to do the interview. And again, the website is mystorm.uk. And do you have a website?
No, most of my stuff is on the MyStorm.
Forum. Okay, and there's a forum at forum.mystorm.uk. Links will be in the show notes as well as photos of the booth. Okay. Hi, and we're at the Free Software Foundation booth, and your name is?
My name is Eric Kuhn.
And what is the Free Software Foundation for those that don't know?
Well, the Free Software Foundation is a non-profit organization that tries to empower people to basically get back control over their technology, which means use free software and promote it wherever possible.
What's free software?
Free software is software. It's like open source, but it has a certain philosophy. So software has to follow four freedoms to be called free software, and that is you have to be allowed to use the software for any purpose. you must be allowed to study the software, so you must have the source code available. You must be able to share the software with your neighbor or your friend or whoever, so they can also benefit from the same software as you are. And if you make any improvement to the software, for example, you fix a bug or you add a feature, you must be able to publish that feature so that the whole community can benefit from that.
And how is this different to, say, something like the BSD license?
The BSD license is, or which BSD license, of course, because there are many, but the BSD license is a permissive, or as I like to call it, pushover license, because as soon as you start, it's also still a free software license, and it's still better than publishing your software as a proprietary software. But it allows anybody who wants to use the software or to republish the software to do so as proprietary software, and that's bad for the user.
So I'm looking at some of the things that you have on here. You have something about DRM. So are you promoting DRM?
Of course, we are against digital restriction management, and the flyer is actually quite interesting because. It has a nice example of where DRM is actually quite a bad thing with Amazon, who have their ebook platform, and people were buying 1984 and were reading it, and of course it was protected by DRM. And then suddenly Amazon, from one day to another, they started deleting all copies of 1984.
And which is kind of ironic, actually, given the book.
So I think that's reason enough to be against DRM. So, if you buy a book, a copy of a book or an CD or whatever, you should be able to share it with everybody in your peer group.
Okay, and public money, public code. Tell us about that. That seems logical. I'm paying taxes, so the code should be public, obviously.
Exactly. Public money, public code is our newest campaign, where we try to convince public administrations, so governments, to use, not only use free software, but also if they hire a company to develop a software for them, or they buy a software, they do that with public money, so our taxpayers' money, and that should be published as free software, of course.
I find it very difficult to argue with you on this because I completely, I'm so on board with this as something that should be done that I'm finding it difficult to play devil's advocate here. But let me come up with some, have you heard any arguments against that? Maybe.
Of course not. Everybody is happy to use free software. Argument against, or brought up arguments against, is the security aspect, which I don't agree at all, because if free software is developed in the open, anyone can take a look at the code and improve it and fix security bugs. So they will get even fixed even faster, because more eyes improve the software even faster.
Okay, very good. And what can we do to help the free software along?
Where you can spread, of course, spread our word and share our materials and sign, for example, public money, public code, our open letter, or you can become a supporter at fsfe.org/support and support us financially.
Okay, very good. Thanks very much. And links to this will be in the show notes.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.